And this was only one more that had to be kept because I felt there was no chance of my position surviving an attempt disclosure. And at that time, I didn't see any reason why I should. I thought, this is something that's been given to me. What do I care whether anybody finds out about it or not? They'll find out about it soon enough anyway. But during that trip, I had been constantly asking questions. And to every question that I asked, I got a complete logical answer, in almost every case, an understandable answer. There were a few times when the answer was very difficult. But we couldn't explain, no matter how hard we tried, no matter how intelligent the listeners were. And in some cases, there are some things that can't be explained to us. And it doesn't require a very much higher degree of development than we to make that true. Because if we took a person of our age of 100 years ago and attempted to explain our present science to them, we wouldn't get very far. We wouldn't have to be over 100 years different in development between those races before the things that they have would be completely incomprehensible to us. And there were some things that I didn't completely grasp, but there were some things that I did. I was aware of the fact that there were a few apparent discrepancies in our physical science of today. Any good physicist will admit that they exist, and the better physicist he is, the more readily he will admit it. And I was concerned about answers to some of those things. I did a little discussion, and I got a few answers. And after this time, I decided that that would be the determining factor as to whether or not I would ever make public what had happened and risk the consequences. It happened that I was employed at that time in a job which gave me complete access to some of the best instrumentation in the world, electronic instrumentation and other types. It also gave me complete access to all sorts of machine tools because I was employed in a job where I was making gadgetry instruments for making measurements where no such instrument was yet available on the market. And I made use of this opportunity both in my spare time and as much of the company's time as I thought I could get away with in building hardware, test devices, for the purpose of checking these concepts. And if any one of those concepts had failed, I would never have said or written a single word about the experience. When they did not, I began to feel that perhaps I was in possession of information that was of more value than I wanted to have. And I began to feel that perhaps I had no right to continue to conceal this, maybe because I was afraid of what might happen to me. And so I determined to make a report as brief as possible and make it available. And I wanted it. I had no idea at that time of publishing it. I never did. I was requested to do this by a man who subsequently published it, although I never approached him to ask. But I decided to make a report, and then if anyone is interested, I would simply encourage it to be great. At that time, I thought, I'll certainly never defend this. I'll certainly never get up on a platform and discuss it or defend it with anyone. If anyone's interested, I'll merely refer him to the report, and I will do that. Well, it hasn't quite worked out that way. I did make the original report very, very simple. It's, as anyone reads it from a scientific standpoint, will point out that it is oversimplified, which has to be true, because if any of the concepts involved were explained at length, it would require a large volume for each one. And in the first place, I didn't have the neurons to write that large volume. So I made it as simple as possible. Then later there was a question of motivation for work. And I attempted to also make a report on this in as short a form as possible, as described and explained. And finally, there were so many challenges, so many requests about, well, just what was the new understanding that you received concerning the mathematics connected with relativity? And so I determined to also make a report on that, which is the third book. It's called Start. Again, each time I wrote another one of these reports, I thought, well, this is the end. I'll certainly never have to
carry this again because I really don't care in the least whether anyone accepts it or not. Why should I? That's considerable expense to myself, and not make any mistake. I spend $10,000 a year at my own hard-earned money that I make as an instrument engineer and making this information available to the public. But I've asked about what's the answer. Doesn't seem to be doing any good, and then once in a while, I will receive a letter from a person in some high position that seems to indicate that it is worth it. And so this keeps me going. But this is essentially the story. I've taken a lot more time than I thought I was going to. We can now throw this to the wolves, and I don't mean any disrespect to the individuals present, but I want to explain a process we have in Crescent Engineering. This is where we get the terms. I design most of the transducers that are made by Crescent. But before any is manufactured or put into production, I have to write a theory of operation. And we have a group of engineers in the plant which control the wolves. As soon as this is written, it's thrown to the wolves. And their sole purpose is to take this thing apart and find every possible flaw that they can find in it. It's very stimulating to care in theoretical work because any errors, any flaws are facing and very thoroughly concluded. So since I'm completely familiar with this operation, I
thought
let's throw this to the wolves and see what
comes out. We just heard Dan Fry tell his story, the experience that he had a few years back, and he will be appearing at Palm Gardens Ballroom tonight at 8 p.m. That Saturday night. That's located in Midtown Manhattan, 52nd Street near 8th Avenue. And he has a lot more stories to tell, experiences that he has had, and there'll also be a question and answer period. So this will give you the opportunity to participate, to ask questions, and I think it'll be of great interest to all of our listeners.
With our guest of the morning.
I think we'll start with you, Ben. Supposing we do it this way. Supposing we go around and around the table here, and we try to keep it down to about 10 minutes at a time, and eventually we'll get back at the beginning.
This time we'll make it to the end, okay?
Yes, and I also wanted to comment that although this fabulous Cinderella holiday vacation was designed especially for young people, I think that you could even go on this little court anyway.
Because there'd be enough young people around that could sort of direct you and guide you.
Okay,
I
don't
feel that you're myself.
I don't know
what they're doing.
I beg
pardon?
I beg pardon.
Few people are
very
liberal here. I don't have to be said. I don't have to be said for the next month because I have been stuck to the gills with Betty Leedon's spaghetti tonight. It was very great, though.
Your gills are showing, Ben.
Well, seriously, there were a great many things that I wanted to talk to you about. I didn't quite understand one point. You said something about, well, I don't understand a lot, but particularly one point where you said that you realized that you weren't having an hallucination because when the grass was settling to the ground, there was a sound of crackling underbrush.
No, I don't give this as an evidence that it wasn't hallucination.
No, but I mean, you remember hearing the sound of crackling underbrush.
Yeah.
And then later on, the next day or so, you went back and you saw that your footsteps came to an end according to some circle. The footsteps were where? In the underbrush?
Well, I had circled the craft after I approached it. I was some 70 feet or more away when I said it. But I approached it first and circled about it.
Well, was this a generally an area filled with shrubbery and underbrush?
There's underbrush there.
But a person could make...
No, Desert, of course. You can walk through it. The underbrush isn't that thick in Desert.
Sage? Well, there's a number of types.
Yeah, there isn't too much sage there.
And
There are two other things I want to ask principally about is that you said that the question is that you're testing out these principles of different new types of technology that have been revealed to you, and these principles have been...
This wasn't a new type of technology. It was merely answers to some certain places where our present technology didn't seem to have adequate answers.
And these things worked out, and these things are now perfected?
Well, the hardware performed the function which it's already considered performed under the concept.
And where are these instruments and electronic hardware now?
Some of them are in the laboratory at this moment, man.
In other words, these things actually do exist.
That's right.
And also, I think the thing with my ears, for instance, you said something that I didn't quite get exactly how you put it. You said something about what had been revealed to you about the mathematics of Einstein's theory of relativity?
There was some discussion. You'll find it, if you want to get it, you'll find it in books, books as far as written out just as simply and completely as I can write it. Subjects like this. The limitation that we have applied to what we call the quantum PC or the velocity of light. The average person will state, if you ask him, that velocity of light is an absolute permitting velocity, that nothing can have a velocity greater than the velocity of light.
I've so stated.
The problem that came to me is how do we determine what velocity an object has? If we're going to make this thing an absolute figure, we have to have a zero reference point which we can measure. Since all of the known bodies of matter in the universe are in motion, and all of them are in motion with respect to us, and in motion with respect to every other body of matter in the universe, where do we find an absolute motionless reference point from which we can measure velocity and determine whether this is an absolute thing or a relative thing? As a matter of fact, Dr. Einstein labeled his paper, which he issued in 1905 as a theory of special relativity. We have since converted
special
that to
paper.
He called it a paper on a new theory of special relativity.
Now, I'm pretty sure that it's the 1915 paper is called a special theory on relativity in the
1905 was the first one. It was issued in 1905. It's called a special theory on relativity.
Well,
then
in
1915,
one
was issued called...
The second one, the general theory.
Well, the first one is special theory, the second is... Anyhow, we have made it a theory of absolutes without any reference point. And
the theory of relativity is a theory of absolutes?
Well, we have attempted to make it so. He pointed out quite carefully in a foreword to that paper, he attempted to eliminate or to forestall the thought blocks which he realized would come about. But that forward were not written. Unfortunately, that forward has been almost completely lost. I've only seen it in print once, and that was in a work which he himself wrote concerning his theory. I've never seen it quoted anywhere else.
Was this something you had arrived at before your own...
No, I hadn't arrived at it. I hadn't arrived at any answer.
No, I mean these ideas about the Einstein theory of relativity. Is this something you had arrived at, or something that the person who was controlling the spacecraft had
this was a question I asked just as you were asking questions.
As a result of the space trip?
No, it didn't have anything particularly to do with the space trip. It was merely the fact that I found I could ask questions and get answers, and I thought this was a wonderful opportunity to get some answers to something that I might not be able to get anywhere else. And also the answer that was given, or the validity of the answer that was given, might give some indication of the value of the remaining statements that were made.
And the question was, how can we assume a speed for light when we don't know what zero point to start at?
In general, what I wanted to have explained was how we can say that there is a limitation of velocity when velocity to us is a completely relative thing. You can only measure velocity by observing two points. A point at which the observer exists and some other point or two other points, and we can observe whether or not they approach or recede. We can observe the rate at which this goes on. Mm-hmm. And we say this is the motion of the two objects, but both of those objects may have an almost infinite motion in space.
Well, in order to get your thinking on this, would you mind if I ask you a hypothetical question?
I may have to give a hypothetical answer.
Suppose you were standing in the middle of a railroad track, and there was a train racing away from you at the speed of 100,000 miles per second, assuming this train could go that fast. On the back of that train, on the caboose of the last car, was a lantern that was hanging on to the train, attached to the train. So it, too, was, the lantern was traveling 100,000 miles per hour. On one side of the track, there was a shack, a stationary shack in which a light was shining. Now, you could see in your line of vision both the lantern from the disappearing train, which was receding from 100,000 miles per hour, and the light coming from the shack. Now, would you say that the light coming from the lantern on the back of the train was coming to you 100,000 miles per second slower?
No. The light would be moving exactly the same direction.
All right. Now, let's say that...
Because the light is emitted within zero time. The light, the velocity which light has nothing to do with the velocity of the object which emits it, because it's emitted in zero time.
Now, let's say that that train was coming towards you at the rate of 100,000 miles per second. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that, you know, such a thing is coming to you. Would you say that the light that was, say this time was a locomotive flashlight, a headlight, would you say that the light and the headlight was approaching you at 286,000 miles per second, while the light in the shack was approaching you at 186,000 miles per second?
The light in either case would have the same velocity. It would have a great deal of difference. However, in its frequency, you wouldn't be able to observe the light in either case. If the light at the source of light was moving away that rapidly or towards that rapidly, you wouldn't be able to observe it at all because its frequency would be removed beyond the spectrum of visible light.
But
the velocity of the photons themselves would be exactly the same. The velocity at which a photon is emitted indicates a point in space. It has nothing to do with the velocity of the thing that emits it.
No, I'm not talking about the velocity. I'm talking about the speed of those actual light rays.
That's what I'm talking about. They're the speed of the light particles. It has nothing to do with the speed of the object which emits it.
It would not be irrational of me to assume, if I were the observer and not you, it would not be irrational for me to assume that the speed of those light rays coming from that locomotive headlight were approaching me 100,000 miles per second faster than the one from the shack, would it?
It would not be irrational if you based your belief only on our present concept, which is one of the greatest illustrations of the hazards of basing beliefs entirely on our existing concept. We think that velocities are additive because this is what we observe. If you have a cannon on an aircraft, and you fire that cannon while the aircraft is in motion, you fire it in front of the plane, going in the direction the plane is going, the shell, as it leaves the plane, will have the normal muzzle velocity of the plane plus the normal velocity of the shell plus the velocity of the plane. With respect to an observer who is motionless, we say, again, we run up against this problem which you can't define at any point of being motionless, but relatively motionless.
It would not be irrational of me to assume.
It wouldn't be irrational, no, except that it doesn't happen to be correct.
So therefore, I came out and made the statement, if I was standing in the middle of that railroad track and I looked at the approaching locomotive and I looked at the light coming from the railroad track and I pronounced ex cathedra to all and sundry that the light coming from that railroad locomotive, the light coming from that railroad track was approaching me at the same speed of 186,000 miles per second, I would therefore be making a postulate, wouldn't I? I was saying, I deduce this to be true. I assume this to be true. This is a starting point.
You can assume it to be true, but if observation indicates it isn't true, then you have to change it.
Isn't this what Einstein did?
True. He produced a mathematical theory, which is perfectly correct. There isn't a thing wrong in the world with those mathematics.
Well, there are physical applications, so forth.
There is something wrong with the interpretation which we sometimes place.
No. This is the one point where I leave you.
Well, 100,000 miles. This is the point where most people is. Because they are still determined to use our earthly concepts as...
No, this is not an earthly concept, but for the point that I don't quite follow is that I...
I never assumed that or understood how mathematics was subject to interpretation. It was subject to verification, which the relativity theory has to.
True, mathematics are subject only to verification as mathematics.
Well, mathematical physics.
If I say x plus 2 equals something else, we can prove it is true, but it doesn't mean a thing until we apply that specific value.
Verification.
It's verification, subject to verification mathematically, because we arrange our mathematics ourselves. These are arbitrary
things.
That's
quite true of the mathematical system, but this is not. This is a mathematical explanation of a physical theory which has been verified by physical experimentation.
True, and I have never objected to any part of it. But,
well, I thought you were.
No, not at all. This is the point where you leave me, because you haven't seen the basic
Greek. What Dr. Einstein said when he wrote his theory on his theory of special relativity, or special theory of relativity,
whichever you choose, he said this: all of the knowledge
which we have concerning the universe about us comes to us through our senses. Therefore, if we are to formulate mathematical laws concerning the universe, we must begin with the postulate that what our senses tell us is true.
This means that if we observe through a large telescope the formation of a nova in a distant galaxy, and at the same time, Stein said this, at the same time we observe the eruption of a volcano upon our own Earth, we must, for the purpose of our mathematics, assume that these two events are simultaneous.
He said, it is true that this is a difficult concept to accept, because the faculty which we call reason immediately interposes the objection that a separation in space involves an elapse of time between the event and our perception of it. But if we are to allow our reason to interfere before our mathematics are complete, we'll be evolving a concept whose value is based only upon the validity of our reason and not upon the accuracy of our observation. What he meant was, we must formulate the mathematics first. We must not allow reason to enter into the picture at all. We must take what we see as being absolute. Then, when we have completed our mathematics, then we can allow reason to deal with what we have.
This was Albert Einstein, the Institute of Einstein.
I think the next one, I think we'll have Lester Del Rey. Do you have some questions?
Well, I'd like to leave a song for a row which has been sufficiently generalized so far, and aware that it's a little hard to tackle, and get back to something that strikes me as more important. As I understand it, your first reaction when you were standing there in front of the spaceship was that you were worried about what others would think. What credibility, in other words, if you ran back.
Not the first reaction. That was the reaction that occurred to me when I questioned whether or not I should attempt to get something else.
Well,
to look at
it was a reaction. Then you found that generally this person aboard, the person or voice, whatever, aboard the spaceship, was generally pretty careful. Even in the words he didn't force you to come along, but said you can if you want.
Sure. I wonder if I can interrupt a moment. I think that although we're trying to allot just 10 minutes of time for each one of the people sitting around the table, I think we should take a break at this time, a coffee break for 20 minutes.
Right.
I've got just one question. I think I just got the background.
All right, fine. If you find that some clues.
All right. All I want to ask is this. As long as you have the opportunity, why didn't you ask to have somebody else come along with you?
Well, now, let's wait. You hold that answer till we get back. We're going to take a 20-minute coffee break, and then we'll be back with Dan Fry.
In case you've just joined us, Mr. Fry
told us in about 55 minutes about a very unusual experience that he had a few years ago, and he was invited to take a ride in a flying saucer. He went from the White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico to New York and back, a distance of some 4,000 miles in about 30 minutes. He told us this story, and
after he completed the story, Ben Iskowitz questioned him about some of the statements that he had made, and now Lester Del Rey.
Well, I'd like to restate my question, because I'm afraid the pangs of hunger made it rather hasty. What I'm driving at, what do I call you, Dan or Mr. Fry?
Either one.
All right, Dan, because that's simple. You have been in a position where you have made, well,
the need of evidence.
In much of what you do, you've got to have the evidence to back up anything that you say. Money and everything else would be riding on it.
This is assuming that I'm trying to prove something.
All right, fine. Your first reaction, however, was one of... Not your first. I beg your pardon. You corrected me on that. You had a reaction of the fact that if you were caught in that position, if you said anything about it, if you asked for help, I don't know exactly how you phrased it, but anyway, you were conscious of the fact that it would be a good idea to have something ready to support it or else to be very quiet about it.
Now, you had a very courteous
invitation by this voicemail officer, I gather, to come along. He was perfectly willing, I say he for lack of any other knowledge of such, he was perfectly willing to give you a demonstration. I'm sure that he would have waited a minute or two longer while you got somebody else who wasn't too far away to take with you. Not only did you not do that, but apparently never occurred to you, which I find somewhat surprising. In addition to which, after it was all over, and there were at least the footprints on the ground, you were tromping around on those footprints, jumping around on them, and destroying even those.
Now, this is a little surprising to somebody who values evidence.
Well, actually, this isn't a question. This is an argument. But I could give any one of at least three different logical answers to it. Unfortunately, none of them would be true. It is true that had I thought about the subject at all, it probably would have occurred to me. In the first place, I couldn't have gotten anyone in two or three minutes. I was between half and three quarters of a mile from the main road, which led to the base, at least a mile and a quarter from the nearest other individual that I could have reached. And I had no means of locomotion except footsteps. It would have required at least three quarters of an hour to have gotten anyone there. If I had thought about it, it probably would have occurred to me that this individual possibly might not be that anxious to prove his existence to some things that he perhaps wasn't too interested in anyway. Also, had I gone to get one other person, I would probably have had dozens there, all of whom would have been clamoring to have the same evidence, and it would have been a question of precedence arise as to exactly who was going to ride. And if I'd brought one or two other people along and given them the ride, it would only have meant that three crockpots had been generated instead of him. The world reaction, the general public, wouldn't have been any more ready to believe three people than they would want. Or not noticeably more ready. But the plain fact of the matter is that it simply didn't occur to me. And you say this may appear illogical, but if I were to ask any one of you here what you would do if you sat in your work in the middle of the night and found your house was on fire, the fire was well advanced, and you knew that you had time to save only one or two items of your belongings, now, which items would you save? In almost every case, I would get a very logical answer or something to this effect. Well, first I would go get my bond box, which has all my negotiable securities, and then I would save my wife's jewelry, and then I would go after this and that. But if you actually wake up in the middle of the night and find the house is on fire, you'll probably find yourself running out on your front lawn with a picture of old Aunt Maria that hung over the fireplace in which you have always said you were going to take out to the garage anyhow because you couldn't stand it. Unfortunately, under circumstances of stress such as this, the human being just doesn't react always in a logical manner. There are many things about this experience probably which were illogical, just as there are things illogical about the action of anyone who suddenly finds himself in circumstances beyond any that he has imagined before.
Well, I'm not basically trying to quarrel with you on this. Literally and honestly curious about your reactions.
Mm-hmm.
Because, to be perfectly frank with you, superficially detailed a story as I've heard so far. Most of them break apart on internal evidence.
Yours breaks apart much less. Therefore, I have to look for personal reactions and other things to judge it on.
Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't mean that I buy a word of what you said.
Well,
it doesn't mean that I say that you're lying to me either.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also curious a little bit about the reaction of this person or voice in letting you go. It strikes me as being a little bit juvenile in the action. You express some doubt, so he says, well, this isn't designed for it. We don't want to ordinarily have anything to do with humans, apparently, or it would seem that the ship wasn't even built for it. But hop aboard, and I will take you 3,000, 2,000 miles and back.
On the spur of the moment, he says that. That is, that's a little bit unusual for somebody who I would consider a fairly confident, self-assured person. Should be, at least, if he has all the technology behind it.
Now, this is true. This goes to the motives of offering this test stop in the first place, and unfortunately, I don't know what they were. Again, if I were to consider the reactions of this individual purely on the basis of our own reactions in similar circumstances, there probably would be some question. And then there could be logical explanations based on our own psychological reactions. Unfortunately, I don't know whether the psychological reactions of this individual have any similarities or ours or not. And I don't know whether or not there is any other reason involved than merely the desire to satisfy my objection. It could have been. It could have been something entirely different. I don't know. These are quite delicate problems because they're based on fairly fine turns of our own psychological thinking. And since they're being applied to an individual who presumably at least was considerably different, or might have been at least considerably different, it's hard to formulate any logical answer to the question of how a person would react in a certain circumstance if he was completely different from us, or if he didn't follow the same thought pattern. I don't know entirely why this hop was offered. I tell you that it was probably offered as a result of my expressing some skepticism. It may have been not only that with this one case, it may have been a cumulative degree of skepticism that has existed here. It may have been the thought that, possibly it was time to show a little more definite evidence of the existence of these beings. Again, this would imply a motive, of which I'm not sure. Perhaps it had some definite motive that had nothing to do with merely demonstrating the shift to me personally.
There's one thing on the science that I'm also curious about. You mentioned that, which is quite true, that if you could accelerate every particle of matter inside the ship, there would be no feeling of acceleration.
And you said something about it being like a gravitational force.
Where was that force located? At the very front of whatever part of the ship was in the front, then?
The field probably would be distributed throughout the ship, but would be more intense at one certain point, which probably led the ship. Again, as I say, an attempt was made to explain it in detail to me. Unfortunately, the same condition that would apply to the natives in Australia applied to me, that there wasn't a sufficient number of terms in our language to make it completely comprehensible. I have done a certain amount of private work in an attempt to enlarge these concepts or complete them. In this respect, I'm not alone. There are at least three companies on the West Coast which have Davidic programs in operation today, and I have on several occasions in public talks taken the risk of predicting that we will have Davidically controlled crafts in the air in this country within 10 years.
Gravitics.
That's a word that's been around for a long time. It hasn't been used too much heretofore, but it's one that we might as well get used to because we're going to hear a lot about it in the future.
Well, if this is located at the front, though, won't you have unequal force? It would have to be, it has to be absolutely beamed in order to avoid the summit in some degree of the inverse square effect of falling off the force toward the end, toward the sides.
There would probably have to be some degree of it. As I say, this approaches technology that we know very little about yet.
Did you ask them about this?
We have a gravitational field about this Earth. If we have a sphere which is within that field, and we drop two balls to equal lead shot at different parts of that sphere, we find that they fall at the same speed, even though they may be in different parts of the ship. Now, the ship has a field itself, and the Earth has a field. The negative kinetic energy differential, or the motion that is created by the action of these two fields, tends to reduce the degree of separation or the distance between them. And at least in the case of the sphere and the Earth itself, we would find great difficulty in noticing any difference in the velocity of balls at different parts. Now, it may be that the center of this force is located at a point in the ship where this difference in gravity wouldn't be noticeable. The seats did leave. The seats were at the forward part, or ahead of the center of the ship. Location and more ahead of the center. If the center of the field were located at that point, you wouldn't notice any difference. There would be a slightly different amount of force applied to various parts of the ship, but the ship being a unit would respond as a unit. And the body being at the center of the field would also respond as a unit. These are problems that we would probably have to write a thesis 100 pages long to even begin to approach some mathematical data on it.
Now, one final thing. You said something when answering Ben about the 100,000 miles second velocity of the lanterns and so on, that at that the Doppler shift would be enough to put the red light beyond the range of human vision. Now, I'm not absolutely sure, but are you sure that it would?
It seems to me that this would still be well down within visible light.
No, I think if you'll check it up, you'll find that it would be, that no matter which direction it was traveling, that much shift. Now, we have a Doppler red shift, which we use to, or have used, to estimate the velocity of recession of the more distant stars. We had a very nice set of technology built up around us in astronomy. We had calculated the radius of the visible universe and the probable radius of the entire universe as far as the matter was concerned. And we also had very careful figures on the age of the Earth. And it came out about 2 billion years for the age of the Earth and about 2 billion light years for the diameter of the visible portion of the universe and about 35 billion light years for the entire diameter of the universe. We had everything worked into this very nicely. We even had the gradient clock timed down so it fit it very nicely. And then suddenly, a thoughtless character by the name of Walter Bade decided to recalibrate the secret variable star. His man had worked at Mount Wilson Observatory and later at Palomar, and he undertook to recalibrate the secret variables, which was the point of this inverted pyramid upon which all this data was built. Unfortunately, he came out with a large discrepancy on his subsequent calibration, and they announced the astronomy, the science of astronomy, announced casually to the world that they would now have to increase all the dimensions by a figure equal to 2.8. Which demonstrates only one thing, that many of our sciences, especially the science of astronomy, which is considered to be a very precise science, is in most cases built exactly like this. It's an inverted pyramid that's based on a single posture. We say if this is true, then that shows that these two things are true, and a little more observation shows that these four things are true, and if they are true, then these 8 or 16 things are true, and so on. We build it up on a point, and if something comes wrong and knocks that point out, then we have to readjust the whole thing. And of course, this has been going on as long as we've had a science. But no matter where we are in our present position in science, we'll always accept that as absolute and say that anything that deviates from our present belief, it can't be accepted. Perhaps it's a good attitude to accept because it prevents us from making too many mistakes. But if it becomes too absolute, it also prevents us from making any progress. And we assumed at that time, when we assumed the size of the universe and the length of time it existed, we assumed that the recession, the maximum rate of recession of the more distant stars was about 25,000 miles per second. And this brought about a considerable reduction in the frequency of the light. The only reason that this frequency goes down, of course, is because light is emitted in zero time, so it has the same velocity, but if there is a time elapse between successive emissions, which we call the frequency of light, then of course they're farther apart and the wavelength increases. If the source is approaching, then the waves are closer together than would be normally. And in order to determine how much the wavelength changes, we only have to divide the frequency by the velocity of light. Now, at 100,000 miles per second, you would get approximately 3/4 of an octave change. So it's fairly easy to calculate whether or not a light that's already red would go into infrared with 3/4 of an octave change.
You said this in terms of the increase rather than the decrease in speed. That's what it was. It was over 1 hour.
Well, no, when it was first brought up, I didn't propose any objection when the light was coming for it. Only when the light was receding. It would make a change. It would make good Doppler shift in either way. Either direction, you'd easily be able to recognize. But it's easy to determine precisely what shift it would make. Because the wavelengths are quite precisely known, and if you apply a change of 3/4 of an octave, right, you can predict how much the light is going to change. Carl, is anything?
No, Darren, just started out. How many minutes do I have, John? Half a minute?
Well, 10 minutes. Actually, we've been running about 12 minutes or so, but you have a stopwatch in front of you and should be running.
Ben over there had 18 o'clock.
18 minutes.
But at any rate, Dan, getting back to your beginning, you said something about taking me to your lecture. It reminds me of a cartoon that was in their paper not so long ago. Of course, the usual, a very gross caricature of humanoid, as apparently man on this earth can't get used to the idea of creatures in the other part of the universe perhaps being as good-looking as man conceives himself to be. These pointed head, bespectacled or be-helmeted individuals.
Get out, man. One of them walked up to a fire hydrant and said, take me to your leader. That seems to be about the concept that we have from our movies and all that kind of thing.
Dan, when you were talking about getting on this ship for a test hop, you mentioned a viewing screen, but you didn't say where that was, nor how sizable it was, nor its location.
Well, it actually was the doorway or hatch to which I had come.
Oh, that became transparent?
It was the material, yes. Mm-hmm. Fortunate that taking place to permit entry and then the throat.
If that was 1 inch thick, as you described it, and
well, these are estimates that were made under considerable tension.
I'm not trying to pick you up on that. I'm just trying to emphasize the fact that this was what would appear to us to be 1 inch thick solid metal, which is,
we don't consider metals being transparent.
Okay. Although, as you point out, certainly there's vastly more space than even these solids that we have, than we have any idea about, but our vision is too dense to see that. Now, when you ask these questions of your, man or voice, because you didn't see anybody.
No, I
didn't. Did you think them, or did you ask those physically?
I spoke aloud. In considering the situation since that time, I don't think it would have been necessary. I don't know, but because of habit, because we always do, I speak aloud, I spoke aloud.
Did you receive your answers in an audible voice?
I heard them as sound, yes. Uh-huh. I heard them as sound exactly as you hear my voice. Again, I am not certain whether there were any vibrations in our presence. We have the idea that the only way you can hear is to have vibrations in air impinge upon our eardrums. And we think we hear these vibrations in air. We hear the sound. But anyone who thinks that has only to cut the auditory nerves of the ear and see how much sound you can perceive.
What actually happens is when a vibration strikes the front of the ear, it oscillates, and in turn, oscillates the temporal angle, the vibration of the fifth person in the ear. And the auditory nerve flies between the ear, and a very minute galvanic current is modulated by the auditory nerve in the brain.
It's this minute galvanic current that the brain perceives the sound, it's the only thing the brain can perceive. And if that current can be modulated electronically or by any other means, other than vibrations in air, we can still be made to hear exactly the same as though there were vibrations present in air. This is one of the little devices I have at home that proves this very definitely. It is possible to hear with no vibration in air at all. In fact, we are working now on a hearing device which should permit anyone to hear, even though his normal hearing apparatus is completely destroyed. There's one nerve that terminates in the hollow of the kneecap, which is almost as efficient for hearing as the auditory nerve itself.
It looks really peculiar with ears on our knees, won't it?
Yes, it looks peculiar, but people who are stone deaf, I don't think will bark at wearing a hearing device.
Sure they won't, Dan.
I don't want to interrupt, but I can just picture a fellow walking down the street with glasses on his knees, because most of the hearing aids that go into that.
Since when did you look through your ears? Dan, this idea that you have, was that your own, or was that given to you?
Which was it?
About this hearing.
Yes, it was done in an attempt to explain, in physical terms, exactly what had happened.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned further, Dan, that I wasn't quite clear. Did you get this from your contact, the voice? How do you want to call it?
We should identify it by some kind of name.
The voice, the only correct way to speak about it is the voice. Unfortunately, this sounds very psychic, Bud.
Did he give you a name?
During the last few minutes of his contact, it occurred to me to ask. It hadn't up to that time, and normally when we suddenly meet up with someone in these circumstances, we don't ask first, well, what's your name? It seemed highly impolite to do it. It did occur to me finally to ask if the individual had a name. I didn't even know whatever race this individual represented had a name. The reply was yes, but and again I say he. And again I don't know. I don't know whether this individual was male or female, because unfortunately this is one of the things that we didn't go into. And it's another thing. You don't ask, are you a he or a she?
I assumed
that it was male. Perhaps, again, this was my own ego, because we like to assume that important characters are the same sex as we. But I did ask if this individual had a name, and the reply was yes, that they did have names, although it was seldom necessary to use them among their own group.
What was the name, Dan?
Our name given was Alon.
Oh, okay. Well, now, you mentioned that the lack of man's understanding was... Let me start that one again. Because man could not understand this acceleration, and it would indicate to the Alan that we were quite backward in our comprehension. Is that correct? Was that your idea?
No, I don't know whether it's comprehension. It was merely a question of intelligence or ability to see the facts that are before us. And apparently it seemed to them that everyone should understand, knowing what we do about acceleration of fields. But we should assume, in as much as no propeller blades or much more have been observed on this craft, that they were accelerated in field. And if this were true, then our concept of acceleration by pushing against the pilot's back of the seat was no longer valid.
Okay, did he state this, or was this your interpretation?
That's what I was asking.
No, it was the operation of the ship in the field was explained, he stated.
But he didn't.
And the fact that it appeared to them that we should be able to understand this was a little trouble.
Oh, he did so say. Yeah,
right, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went on a little further to mention the difficulty. It was quite a good analogy, I thought. The difficulty of explanation to you, because you didn't have the background, although you were certainly vastly in the fore of the vanguard of our newer development. And yet, because you didn't have that knowledge, it would be very difficult for him to explain the machine to you as it was, would be for us to explain it to some aboriginal natives.
It would be difficult to give a degree of understanding which would permit a duplication of the machine. Mm-hmm. Its operation was explained quite precisely. Its operation was explained, that is, the production of the field was explained as a resultant field, which was created by the rapid counter-rotation of two powerful charges about the periphery of the craft. It was not explained how those charges were created or how they were caused to rotate, but that there were two charges. They rotated, they were in counter-rotation. They were the same charge, same sign. And that if the charge were positive, the field created was in opposition to the gravitational field. If it were negative, it was in conjunction with the gravitational field.
You object to the term anti-gravitational, don't you?
Well, I don't object to it. When I hear it, I usually point out the fact that this is probably the thing that has prevented us from having gravitic craft before this, because we have adopted a negative attitude toward it. You still see it wherever you go. When you hear someone talking about space travel, they say, well, first we have to conquer gravity. First we have to destroy gravity, we have to shield ourselves from gravity, or we have to overcome it. These are the only three possibilities that we've ever envisioned. And they're all negative. We're all attacking this thing. It's never occurred to us. The old saying has never occurred to us. If you can't let them join you, you've been trying to lick this force for thousands of years, and we haven't made any any headway except in overcoming. We have been able to overcome it by applying a superior force, but it's quite a wasteful and a complex investment. Project. As you always find, when you accomplish an end by applying one natural law against another.
Dan, excuse me, I'm sorry.
For instance, to give a simple explanation of what I mean, if you take a permanent magnet, a bar involved in a permanent magnet, and a similar bar of soft iron of exactly the same shape and size, and you hand these to a person who is intelligent but completely uneducated, ask him to examine this thing for the purpose of determining its properties. After a couple of years of playing around with this thing and examining, one of the conclusions you will undoubtedly come to is that the property of inherent attraction between these two objects cannot be changed or altered or affected in any way. No matter how you approach one of these objects to the other, you find its attraction is different. You'd undoubtedly come to the conclusion that this was an inherent quality and would continue to persist no matter what was done. We know that if you wind a coil of wire around a soft iron bar and induce therein a flow of electrons, you can cause these two objects to exhibit a repulsion for each other just as readily as an attraction. It took us several thousand years to learn how to do this. But until we did learn how to do it, we assumed that it was impossible. Just as we assume everything is impossible that we haven't yet learned to do. But note that when you cause this repulsion to exist between these two bodies, you are not thereby destroying the field of the permanent magnet. You are not shielding the field of the permanent magnet. You are not overcoming the field of the permanent magnet. You aren't doing a single thing to that field except possibly causing lines of force to separate. You're not doing a thing to that field.
And the same is true of these spacecraft. They don't overcome gravity, they don't destroy gravity, they don't shield themselves against gravity. They don't do a thing to our gravity, they simply produce a field that is in opposition to it.
The craft fall away from the Earth, and they fall away just as easily and just as naturally as a stone drop from the tower would fall toward the Earth. This seems fantastic to us simply because we haven't yet learned how to do it. All of our observation is always showing that the stone falls toward the Earth. It isn't any harder to explain why it should fall away than it is to explain why it should fall toward the Earth. But our observation shows that it falls toward it, and so we've had a thought block.
Dan, you mentioned toward the end there that you're being interested, I put it very crudely, you're being interested in this field and talking about it so much since your experience has cost you about $2,000 a year.
That's true. It has every year for at least the last 3 years. The subject of commercialism or desire for monetary gain always comes up and is connected with a subject such as this, and it is usually brought out that when a person lectures, he is paying a fee, which in some cases is true, in about one case out of five. During the last 2 years, I have lectured on an average of twice a week, and not lectured, but spoken on average of twice a week. During the last year, I spoke on average of three times a week, and in the last 9 months, I spoke on an average of four times a week. To various groups who are suddenly becoming interested in this. These are service clubs, school organizations, school boards, colleges. A week and a half ago, I spoke for Wendix Aircraft Management Group, 300 top brass in Wendix Management at their own request, at their own place. In this case, I was paid a fee. In the case of all of the service clubs, 9 times out of 10, no fee is offered, nor do I expect it. Yet I always have to arrange transportation to the place and from it and take time from work and so forth to do it.
Well, of course, the reason for people like yourself being in the saucer field, Dan, is one or two things. Either it's profit motive, which obviously isn't here, or it is a psychic need, perhaps unrealized, but a need to be in the public eye. How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel that if I merely wanted to be in the public eye, I could find many more effective ways of doing it. And doing it in such a way that I would be in the public eye in a more favorable position. To me, there is a great deal of difference between fame and mere publicity. I wouldn't walk across the street to appear on a national chain television program unless I felt that some constructive thing could be accomplished thereby. I had never sought a talk in my life. I've never given a talk anywhere unless I was requested by someone to do so.
Let me interrupt a moment to take care of a little business.
Dan, I'd like to review, go back a small ways to your story of the earlier part of the evening when you first came upon the flying saucer. Frankly, I find your story of your flight across country and circling New York City at night and seeing the gleaming lights and then flying back across the country, I find your story absolutely fascinating. I'm delighted with it, and I can only regret that I wasn't a fellow passenger on this flight. However, Dan, you explained in great detail that the day preceding your saucer flight was an exceedingly hot day, and the air conditioning equipment in your desert headquarters had gone off. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And under this condition of extreme heat, you had taken a small hike out into the desert.
Well, whether or not it was a small hike depends on how you judge the hike. It was a rather small one for me.
Well, it seems to follow naturally that this was an ideal combination of circumstances to give rise to hallucinations.
That possibly is correct, yes.
And you agree that that is possible?
Well, yes, certainly.
And,
this thought was in my mind for quite a while.
And you did certain things to try to check on yourself to find if you could discover valid evidence for this experience, and you had returned to this spot in the desert the next day, I believe, to check and discover whether there were footprints in the sand and so on. And I gather from what you said that you did find some crushed desert growths where the ship had landed.
Well, I found some crushed growths.
Were you able to discover any form or pattern in the crushing of this growth that would indicate that this shaped object had landed in this growth?
Not particularly, only that a portion of one of the boondocks, as we call it. Now, perhaps you'd explain that the area surrounding White Sands there is called colloquially the boondocks. That means simply that as the brush grows, it lowers the speed of the air going through it, which is carrying some sand, and some of the sand is deposited around the roots of the brush, which means that mounds form. Mounds of sand form, in some cases quite high, and in this case, in this area, since there wasn't too much loose sand, they weren't too high. The ship had settled, apparently, on one of the lower areas of this. There was brush there, and there was some sand where it settled. There was a flat spot, not an indentation, but a slightly flat spot. The only indication evident in the world is that some fairly heavy object had settled on that particular area.
Well, I think then that it should be made plain that there was a very excellent chance of this entire experience being a hallucination, or you might have taken a nap and been having trouble with my brain. And you admit that is a...
Yeah, certainly. No person in the scientific field could for a moment avoid considering this possibility, and I consider it quite seriously. I considered a lot of other possibilities, too, and I still consider them. The only point that I make is that, as far as I personally am concerned, the preponderance of the evidence points to the fact that it actually happened.
Well,
I don't deny any possibility that it didn't.
Yes. There are certain logical deductions we can make from what you have told us, Dan. One is that you were dreaming out in the desert under the influence of a great deal of heat. You gave us a very strongly detailed description of the fact that you couldn't prepare this machinery yourselves. You had to wait until the proper mechanics were available to put the air conditioning unit into operation. And so that you had suffered a great deal from this heat.
Well, I wouldn't go quite that far, because I have worked in the desert for a fair portion of my life and have endured heats considerably higher than this. So far as I know, I have never suffered any hallucinations prior to that, nor to my knowledge have I suffered any since. Although, if this was an hallucination, it apparently was a continuing hallucination.
Well, I had spent some time myself out in the center of Death Valley under the noonday sun without any water available, and I know that I recall that I did observe many mirages in the sky, which could easily have been taken for visions of flying saucers. But I want you to get to some other deductions we can draw from your information. You describe that in the interior of this flying saucer there were four chairs, and
I described them as seating devices.
Well, seating
devices. They weren't exactly similar to our chairs, but they were enough like it, so I think it was...
You were able to sit in one of these seating devices, and from that we can deduce that whoever owned this flight, this spacecraft or this flying saucer, was a being who would be capable of sitting on a chair that a human being could sit on.
Yes, probably.
And from this it would follow that this person might be equipped with a pair of legs, or this being might have a pair of legs and a body similar to ours.
We could make an assumption. It wouldn't be too much evidence available because the chair didn't have any particular facilities to accommodate legs, nor did it have any particular facilities to accommodate arms.
Well, there was a seat that was raised.
There was a seat, yes. Apparently, the majority of the mass of the individual rested on a particular part of the seat, which is about the same height as our chairs.
So we could assume, we could pretty well assume that this being had a body which had legs attached to this body. Was there a back to this chair?
There was a back to it.
Which would mean that this wouldn't be an octopus kind of creature that would sit on a chair
I think that an octopus could have sat in it. I don't think that the chair would have been designed as it was to if it had been an octopus that was in question.
And then we're fairly safe in assuming that this being had a body with some legs projected from this body, so it would sit in the chair in the seat.
If we assume that it walked, we'd have to assume legs.
The
configuration of the chair didn't have anything to do with legs, but in order to hasten the discussion, I'm prepared to admit that it is my opinion that the operator probably did have legs.
I'm not trying to contradict you or trap you, Dad. I'm trying to use some rudimentary and crude reasoning processes to discover what we can about what... What were the occupants of these flying saucers? Now, you said there were four chairs, and these chairs had backs to them. These seats or these seating devices had backs, which would mean that the being that would sit in this chair could lean back, possibly, or might want to lean back and rest this being's back, whatever that was. And the entrance door became a transparent window. Were the chairs pointed toward this window?
Yes.
Which would mean that the four pilots or passengers on this craft would be looking through this transparent window. And there was only one transparent window.
True, which indicated that their eyes, whatever seating device they had, were in the front of their heads.
Now, if their bodies were very short or very small when they sat on the seating device, could they see through the window? Or would they have to be as tall as an arch?
No, they could see through it since it extended to the floor of the...
Oh, from the floor to the ceiling?
No, not from the floor to the ceiling, from the far part of the way up on the curve.
Well, now I want to just get one more point in, Dan. I think the other panelists have questioned you on...
To make it short, I'm perfectly prepared to defend the postulate that they were humanoid in shape. I don't know that they were. I can defend it only on theory.
You have also told us that they apparently were familiar with all the cities of the United States. They knew about New York City. They apparently knew our terrain very thoroughly, which indicated that they had studied us pretty well, and they had even gone to the extent of learning our language with its colloquial expressions. They got them a little mixed up, but they did know. Did they knew the names of? Did they use the names of our cities?
The cities were named as we passed over a light pattern. The city was given a name.
So they said
this is such and such a city. I don't know where
they
were. I know
that
these came in
proper. If you weren't having dreams or hallucinations as a result of the heat that came about with the breakdown of the air conditioning system, then this story is valid, then these people have done a pretty thorough study of us, and they know a good deal about us.
I think the evidence would indicate that they are very well aware of the situation.
Well,
this is all testing our atmosphere, too.
Yes.
Dan,
I think Ellery brought it up that there's a possibility that you had a hallucination.
Yeah.
On the other hand, isn't it true that... very frankly, I was out of the studio at our teleprinter a couple of times tonight, and I didn't hear your entire story tonight, but I think that you told us on previous appearances that you have talked to Alan since that first experience in the flying saucer.
Yes, that is correct. That is why I said that if it were an hallucination, it was a continuing one.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. Let me take care of a little business, and then we'll be back with our guests of the morning.
It's from a very stubborn person, because it's addressed to Long John Maughan.
That's interesting.
That's an old code word that we
Go ahead. Dear Long John, I have never heard a college graduate make a statement he has contacted a sorcerer. I would like to know what college or university Dan Fry has attended and what degrees he holds. Signed, Gene Petroselli.
This is a question, of course, which is always brought up by someone. As far as having a college graduate make a statement that they had seen saucers, if I had time here, I could furnish this individual with quite a large list.
I could add
quite a large list,
yes. I could add to
that. Also, there always seems to be a connection here with the old technique or leader idea. The college graduate, or the degree which he achieves somehow or other, seems to have something to do with his eyesight. Or his ability to... as a matter of fact, my training was taken in a number of places. I started in at the University of Southern California upon graduation from high school. And I started just about the time when the biggest depression hit the hardest. And I had been an orphan for some years at that time. And while I had worked my way through high school, I found it impossible to do so at my college. I did complete, essentially, the basic college course through a number of mail order, let's say, courses, correspondence courses, so forth. From the standpoint of the individual who sent in the telegram, probably I have no professional standing. I am, however, the superintendent of research for the Pathfinder Research Company. I designed the instruments which they manufacture, and they have sold something over $1 million worth of these instruments in the last year. And these instruments work. To the question of what sort of an engineer I am, I can reply that people are spending real good money to buy them. This is the best answer I can give to a question of the sort. I don't see that education has anything to do with a person's eyesight.
I'd just like to add to that that when I was out at the convention in Giant Rock Airport, I met a number of people out there, and although I didn't inquire, I didn't ask each one if they had a diploma with them.
They were often wrong.
But nevertheless, there are many people who have college degrees who claim that they've been to other planets and also that tell these fascinating stories. So I think that the question... Well, I won't comment on it.
I wonder what college degree Abraham Lincoln had.
Educated man. Tremendous person.
I've heard that in New York. This was called the other night. Somebody told us down in New York State.
You can, but it's still tough.
I don't mean to belittle anybody, but I understand.
That is the tough way of getting it.
Mm. One of the best good men I ever knew was a man who...
Oh, don't mention my name.
John, I was thinking of you, but I there was one other person, too.
Possible.
You're right.
I'm
glad you were facing,
you know,
some awful cool stuff. Russo finished grammar school. He never had a chance to go to high school. Came up through the STEM, though. He came back in a very big corporation. A wonderfully self-educated individual. Great gauge of mind and attitude. No, man, he's too pessimistic.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it's all right.
Quite all right.
Want to read another one there, please?
This is from Springfield Gardens, New York. Long John. 15 children to age 12 will tell of Josephina the leprechaun, who was a stowaway in the Padres' Catholic, all the way from Ireland to Idlewild, and became the delight of local parochials. La Professor Trivia and his magic beard is soon to be equally appreciated. Children and grown-ups both love the helpless, the unnoticed, and the mysterious and exciting. UFOs are in this category. Let's not have them too realistic too soon. This person wants their name withheld.
I don't see any particular comment. It's just cold.
No, I agree
with the sentiment there.
No comment.
From Brooklyn, New York, Long John. Have artifacts been left behind by UFO on Earth? Signed, Norinsky.
Any comment on that one?
Artifacts of which?
Been left behind on Earth.
By UFOs. Well, we can get into a discussion here that would require at least a full evening period itself. There are a number of artifacts on Earth which we find difficult. In fact, from a pure engineering standpoint, we find impossible to explain on the basis of any technology which we assume existed at the time that these things were assumed to have been created. Such a common pile as the Great Pyramid of Giza.
The what?
Big Pyramid at Giza is one of these. I read a report, is one of these artifacts, which are still in existence, which we find difficult, if not impossible, to explain on the basis of any technology which we assume to exist at the time we assume those things were built.
Why not? Look, it was brought down with the apex pointing downward and then inverted on right off the ground. And how
That's
could that
incredible.
Be, how could that be done otherwise?
Well, I find it much more incredible to believe that the Great Pyramid came from outer space than it was built here.
May I make
No,
a
I don't make a statement.
I think what you need to do is to spend a little more time in the library.
I'm not written about the Great Pyramid at Giza or anything else. It says a mound out in the desert that was built there.
I'm rather assured
But do you know the specific, even a few of the specific details of this mound that you speak of so lightly? Perhaps if you went out to build this thing, you might run into some of the problems that whoever did build it ran into. I read the report last year of a small group of engineers who were on vacation, and they went out there to apply statistics to this thing for the first time, apart from any mystic things. It was perhaps the first time that this thing had ever been approached statistically. And they took the common assumption that the thing was built by laying the first row of stones down and then building a ramp of sand up to the level of the first row of stones and dragging the second row of stones up and then building up the ramp of sand and going and next ramp of stone. So they said, all right, let's force this statistically. Let's first determine the rest angle of the sand, see how long this ramp would have to be in order to not remain there and have any possibility of drawing stones of that size up it, even under the most favorable circumstances. And this conclusion, the entire conclusion of this was that the end of that ramp wouldn't even be in Egypt. And that there probably wasn't enough sand in the Sahara Desert to build it, and there probably wasn't enough water in the Nile to wet the sand down to a point where anything could be pulled over at all. They didn't draw any conclusions. They just issued statistics that their engineering knowledge led them to in a statistical examination of them. Then they began to consider the number of man hours or horsepower hours involved in getting the material of that pyramid, and the base of it covers 13 acres, and it's a pretty big, pile of rock, especially since there isn't any rock of that kind within 50 miles of the pyramid. And the alabaster that covered the outside of it isn't found within 500 miles of the pyramid. And there were a few hundred thousand tons of alabaster on the outside. So they began to consider the amount of manual hours required, and they determined that there hadn't been enough people lived in Egypt since the time when it was supposed to have been built and to have created it. And then they took the question of pulling these things up with ropes attached to a lot of people. Well, here, too, you run into a point of diminishing returns. If you're going to attach ropes to people and have them pull something, you have to have single ropes attached to large ropes and those attached to larger ropes, and the more people you have, the more unwieldy the rope becomes. You reach a point of diminishing returns where no matter how many people you have, they can't even lift the rope. And they found that in this case, they'd passed the point of diminishing returns. Now, they went through the entire thing. They went into the king's chamber and examined the squareness of some of those blocks. They're 4 feet on a side,
They're not put together with mortar. They're simply stacked together, and you can't insert the edge of a safety razor blade in a crack at any point. They determined what this meant in degrees of squareness, and they came out in seconds apart. In fact, in most cases, in fractions of a second apart. They determined that the squareness of these stones was probably greater than the squareness of the average standard which we use today to set up instrumentation, which costs us $300 or $400 for a 6-inch block with one square, with one side square. These stones were square on all six sides to the same degree. And their estimate was that we might possibly be able to build one of these. There might be some engineering company in the country that would take the job of building one of them. But it would be considered a big job. And these things are stacked in there like cordwood. They went through it statistically from end to end, and their final conclusion was summed up in a very brief statement. But what our considered conclusion statistically concerning this pile is that it simply couldn't possibly have been built at all.
Well, I have three ideas about...
I wonder if you could save all three of them for a moment till I remind our listeners that this is WOR Radio, your station in New York.
It's really true. I heard the
phone. Are you going to leave now?
I haven't interrupted anybody for a long time.
I will keep quiet, please, everybody.
Oh,
Ben is going to
build
a pyramid.
I heard this business before about the pyramid being built by space people. And this is something that really thrills me. I always wonder why it's the Egyptian pyramids that everyone is so entranced with. I mean, there are pyramids in the valleys of Mexico that are equally impressive. They're step pyramids. They're equally brilliant architectural feats. They're equally impressive. And no one seems to want to take away the honor of building these pyramids from the people who built them, who I think were probably the Mayans, and give it over to the space people. But they all want to rob the attributes of building the pyramids from the Egyptians and give it off to the space people. And they have not heard about the Mexican pyramids. Also, the statistical analysis about it would take this many ropes, and you would have to have another rope attached to it, and the rope attached to that, and you couldn't even lift the rope. Reminds me about a statistical analysis which was done to prove that at one time in the Earth, thousands of years ago, there was something like 300 trillion people, because you figure that in 1958, there's roughly about 2 or 3 billion people in the world. Each one of those persons have two parents. Each one of those two parents have two parents in turn. Well, two parents in turn. Roughly 2 or 3 generations would exist at the same time. This goes on and on and on. The thing multiplies. So finally, you go back about 1,000 years, you reach gigantic, fantastic amounts of people who are in the... And contrary to fact, we know that the population of the Earth has not decreased from trillions to a few billion. It has actually gone the other way. Also, this business about this kind of stone was 100 miles away and this, all the rest of it. I wonder what a future archaeologist, when he digs up Manhattan Island, is going to wonder about when he finds the fact that the buildings were constructed of steel, there's no steel within 1,000 miles of New York City, and it's constructed of certain kinds of woods, which is 300 miles away, over the Canadian border, and all the rest of it. I mean, these facts
actually, you're making the point now that we attempt to make, that this is only evidence that a technology existed.
Well, that is exactly point I wanted to make, is that when there are recorded statements, king lists, documents, that the pyramid at Giza was built for Cheops or Khufu, and that this goes on and on, that there has been a tradition extending over more than 1,000 years of building pyramids.
And pictures are in the pyramids, then.
Of showing it, of plans for building it, of detailed stories, of inscriptions on the wall, which fit a systemized language describing how these things were built, of all the rest of it. When inside the pyramid we find not a spaceman, but mummies of Egyptians. I mean,
yeah,
I would tend
to... exception to that. There's never been a pyramid, any mummy found in the
pyramid. Ever heard of Tutankhamun?
Not in Giza.
No,
never been a mummy
found in Giza. I said pyramids.
Yeah, well,
sure.
These are the ones in which the... mummies were found with small imitations of
them. The illustrations inside the pyramid, it was showing the method of rolling these blocks up the ramps, were only put up to fool people like yourself and myself, so so that we wouldn't suspect that the spacemen have been there with their saucers.
Well, I don't want to place myself in the position of defending this idea of a spaceman. I don't want to settle. The only point that I am making is that we can't adequately explain from an engineering standpoint, regardless of anything said. I mean, no one has yet explained.
Let me get in on
that. If we can see some actual engineering figures. Now, the only ones I know were presented by this engineering group who were there. If we can see some figures from some other group who can show a way that it can be done by hand, well, I'm willing to accept that if it appears to be valid.
An engineer who's used to working with a diesel engine, usually when it comes to primitive labor, is a fool, because he cannot think in terms of primitive labor.
Absolutely. But
He does not know the power of a twisted piece of wet rawhide. He does not know the power of water on a block of wood, the swelling, the cracked stone. He doesn't know a lot. Now, these are just common ones that everybody knows about. There are a lot of others. As a matter of fact, I had a man once tell me, but a 3-acre piece of land couldn't possibly be cut by hand tools by one man. I mean, the grainer couldn't be cut and shot in one day. He had never heard of a cradle for some strange reason and probably couldn't have used it. But I have done it, and I was a kid then living years ago.
Well, wouldn't you say it's the same people who built who carved out of the solid face of a cliff three gigantic statues of Rameses II could very easily have built the pyramids?
They not only could have done it, but there's every bit of evidence in the world that they did do it. And a lot of this extra fine polishing and so on has been refuted time and time and again.
That's right. This is about not being able to put a razor between the blocks.
Well, of course, I haven't been there.
Well, stick your finger in places there.
I haven't been there. I've only read reports of those who were, so this is subject to check. I wouldn't pretend to defend this until I'd been there myself. I was merely quoting the report. Again, to go back to the cradle is again proving this is an artifact. I say there is an artifact which I have never seen an analysis of which would indicate. No, I didn't say it was an artifact of space. I said there are some artifacts which indicate. The question was whether a degree of technology existed prior to our present one. I said there are some evidence that it did.
Even this cradle.
Now, you made the point again. And you said that this man couldn't play actors of hay in a day because he didn't know about the cradle. Well, the cradle was technology. It was technology that he wasn't aware of. So he couldn't see how it could be done. But in order for it to be possible, it had to be some technology he was not aware of.
Well, we've got 100,000 years, at least, of some kind of technology. The first man who built a fire by himself had some degree of technology.
Well, let's go back to the cave painting.
Well,
these things were first discovered, they weren't believed. I mean, until they actually ran chemical analysis of the polymerization of the oil to prove how all those things were.
I want to say something about Giza. M.K. Jessup, read a book, and I think it was some Englishman who had spent many years taking very careful measurements of the pyramid.
That's right, and what's in the degree off the straight and so on. And he found there's a distinct relationship between the astronomical, I don't know what it was, curvature or something or other. It was an exceedingly delicate measurement, which we, at this time, assumed that the people then didn't even know about. But there was a relationship between that and the height. No, I don't know. There were a whole battery of things.
This is one measurement that has been put over on many people about the fabulous exactness of the astronomical orientation of the pyramids in Egypt. The fact of the matter is that it is rather simple to get superbly exact astronomical measurements with the most primitive instruments. You can take several straight tree branches and join them up into a long stick and extend them out into a kind of compass point and get measurements to the smallest degree of a second of an arc or whatever the finest of measurements you have. It is possible with this primitive instrument to get more exacting dimensional layouts of a building of a structure like a pyramid than you can with many of our modern scientific instruments. And there's nothing terribly difficult about this. Primitive men were very exact and very precise with the instruments they had available and with what they wanted to accomplish.
More exact than our modern scientists.
And the Egyptians predicted eclipses.
They were good mathematicians with what mathematics they had. I think they were excellent. And a primitive flint knife is as sharp as the sharpest razor you can get, if not sharper.
And very
cheap.
Our scientists must be very backward, Ellery, if you can take a group of branches, not even measured for straightness, or perhaps they are measured for it, and be better than our most modern scientific instruments.
There's a good reason for that. There's a very simple explanation. If you take a compass and you try to measure the degrees on a compass, how large is the largest compass that is usually used? As a matter of convenience, it might be 5 or 6 or 10 inches across. All you've got to do is extend this compass to a 10-foot or 20-foot across, and you can divide your degrees into fantastic accuracy, which modern instruments don't give you. They can't give it to you. They're too small. And with a very crude instrument, you can get a higher degree of accuracy than is available with a lot of modern instrumentation.
Well, I'd say this is true in the case of erecting a perpendicular to a line. There are some cases where the longer the leg you have in triangulation, the more accurate the result. And it wouldn't matter too much if the limbs were straight or the rope or whatever you used was straight, as long as it didn't stretch in operation. You could draw a good circle and you could erect a perpendicular to a given line. But the majority of the interesting things in the report of these engineers concerns 9 hours and foot-pounds and so forth of energy, which would have been difficult to discount as much as they were backed by figures of volume and mass and so forth. And while they didn't deny that it could possibly have been built by the degree of technology imagined to exist in, where there was no motive power rather than the human hand, whether we obtained that by twisting wet rawhide or how we obtained it, it's still the number of foot-pounds of energy still had to come from the human muscles.
Well, I would like to pull a note of Chief Carr's proposition here. Give me $20 million. 300,000 slaves will be replenished as fast as used, and 3,000 excellent 12-foot bull whips, and they know how to make them then, with supervisors properly sadistic to handle them, and I will build the pyramid.
Very true. One of our atomic scientists, one of the men working on a satellite program. I can't recall his name at the moment.
Ben Isquith?
No, it wasn't Ben Isquith. I think it was Ben Isquith's father, but I'm not certain. And he made this statement recently that given the amount, percentage of income that the Egyptians spent in building the pyramid, he could, within just several years, put the pyramid of Giza itself into orbit around the Earth.
Well, you know, you explained away very easily, Ellery, what Jessup, who is a pretty well-known astronomer, at least the man I think is rather profound, he explained away very easily, so what he thought was something was nothing. I don't think that man accepts without a pretty severe test in his own mind. Now, I'm not a scientist, as I've said before, nor an engineer. You could explain me away. That's very simple. I doubt very much if you could do that were he here.
There's one item that was left out, I think, and neglected in this statement that the pyramid could be built with 100,000 slaves and the proper number of bullets. There's a considerable section of logistics that was left out there because people don't live very long without food. No matter how abject the slaves they are, they still have to be fed something.
$20 million, we could get a little food from a couple of cans.
Well, it wouldn't last very long. For 100,000 slaves. You'd have to have at least 100,000 other people supplying those slaves with the barest necessities of life, even if you assume that they didn't have to have shelter.
All right. Dan, there's one little story recorded on one of the walls of Egypt about the fact that one group of slaves, and I think there were several thousand or 100,000, who were objecting to the fact that they weren't being fed enough to drag these huge stones up the pyramid. Well, this group of slaves staged a little protest. They said they wanted more food in order to drag these rocks. And the pharaoh's foreman decided there was one simple solution to this problem. Every single last one of these men was simply killed on the spot. And that solved the problem. There was no negotiation and no further trouble.
Yeah, but also his labor force was reduced by considerable. There is still a fact that if you stretch a human muscle too far, it will part. And I don't care how much will there is in the individual.
Egyptians to build the city of Tel Amarna.
Well, I'm not claiming that they did not build it then. I'm only saying
you're just saying it's impossible.
No, I'm saying that there's evidence that a degree of technology existed.
Those
things were built. Right. We are not, in general, prepared to accept
today. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, Long John of the Party Line. Here's a gentleman that sends us telegrams quite often, and unfortunately we receive them about 6 or 6.30 in the morning after we're off the air. We're very happy that we got this one in time. Would you read it, Ben?
This is from Washington, D.C.
Eisenhower?
No, Hopkins of the hospital.
Long John Mars. Fry's statement that a velocity of 100,000 miles per second or more will probably shift visible light into the infrared or ultraviolet, thus rendering it invisible, is incorrect. Stop. Doppler even thought this, but Fizo, showed this was incorrect. Stop. It would cause a shift in spectral lines. Stop. See page 24, Wood's Physical Optics, 3rd edition, signed J.B. Hopkins, M.D.
Well, here we have...
he is right. He's absolutely right.
I wouldn't know. Well, then we'd have to throw out all of the estimated velocities of the planets based on the redshift in the second. Now, this is... I'm prepared to go along with this. We've thrown out many, many more things in our
technology. Well, I think that is one of the biggest hoaxes that is being perpetrated at the present time.
The redshift?
How about the redshift? What does he refer to? What book does Dr. Hopkins refer to?
Wood's Physical Optics.
How about Pierre Quale's third or second volume?
Well, it's a question of authority here, and I think Quale is a greater authority.
One other problem, unfortunately, something else we're going to have to throw out, and that's all of our present telemetering systems, which are based on the Doppler effect. And yet they seem to work quite nicely. We measure the velocity of our missiles by the Doppler effect and the transmitters. We measure quite a number of other constants on missiles, and strangely enough, it seems to work quite well. If we throw out the Doppler effect, we have to find some equivalent thing to take its place.
After all, Dan, you know about the bumblebee. He's not geared aerodynamically to fly, but he doesn't know that, so he does anyway.
Aerodynamically, that no bumblebee could ever fly.
So it must suppose some sort of technology that's beyond
it. Fortunately, it doesn't know this.
Yeah.
He studied genetics.
I think we should do, gentlemen, if I may make this suggestion. We have so many telegrams here. You want to catch up with some of those? Or do you think each one requires an individual answer?
No, just the one that's referred to me. This is from Brooklyn, New York. Long John, you mentioned Atlantis. Was there really such a place? Signed, B. Elliott, Brooklyn, New York. No.
Yeah. I wasn't saying that. I'll tell you what. No, I think we'll have Lester. Can you give us an answer to this in about 15 seconds?
This is
Was there any such a place?
The only man we have who gives us any authentic historical evidence of it was an Egyptian priest reported by a Greek who was a known liar.
Next one.
What about church warden Ignatius Donnelly?
I don't know what all this nonsense is about. Legitimate geologists today accept the existence of Atlantis.
What legitimate one?
I'll bring the names in. I don't have them on hand at the moment.
And then you can't survive. Are you
legitimate geologists?
It may be difficult to prove it incontrovertibly. There's a possibility it did. Maybe it didn't.
That's a classic tonight. It's 5 o'clock.
This is from Flushing, New York. Long John, what will Fry speak at Menger's Farm this Sunday? H. A. Hoffman.
Hoffman must be connected with. Hoffman is involved any time we talk about the mystical Tom Sawyer artist of Brooklyn. Hoffman is any time. I'll only say this: that in all fairness to. Dan Fry. Dan Fry is on the East Coast to give a series of lectures. He'll be giving one tonight at 8 o'clock at the Palm Gardens Ballroom, which is at 52nd Street near 8th Avenue. Now, I also understand that Dan Fry will go out to Howard Menger's Farm in White House, New Jersey this Sunday. He'll be there around 6 o'clock. There's no doubt that he will talk to people. If somebody says, hello, Dan Fry, he'll possibly say hello. But he is not booked to give a lecture at Menger's Farm. Certainly, if you happen to meet Dan, I've known him a couple of years, no doubt he'll try to answer your questions. But in all fairness to Howard and to Dan Fry and to our listeners and to Mr. Hoffman, Mr. Fry is not scheduled to give a lecture.
at the Menger Farm. The lecture will be given tonight at 8 o'clock at Palm Gardens Ballroom that Saturday night, and the admission is $1.25.
This is in Hartford, Connecticut. Long John Mars. Will Ben explain what point he was trying to make by his questions about the speed of light? Also, how does the theory of constancy in speed of light jive with the Doppler effect? Signed, Ray LeBanc. First of all,
you know, Ray, don't you?
Yeah, violin maker.
Yeah, violin maker.
First of all, I never said anything about the constancy of the speed of light. The speed of light changes every time it goes through mediums of different densities. The point I was trying to make is that the formulation of the theory of relativity, the fundamental assumption, one of two that Einstein made, was that the speed of light could not be exceeded. Second assumption he made was that the laws of the universe hold true for all systems. From this, he built up a theoretical system which has been experimentally verified. And the point I was trying to get across was that you do not take observations and concoct all sorts of situations about them. He made a fundamental assumption because he, in fact, it's written one of his statements, I cannot believe otherwise. It was an a priori statement. Brooklyn, New York, Long John Mars. Mr. Fry, since the gravitational pull of the Earth...